sort of unrelated question. I'm trying to weight companies in the airline industry, their ROIC, kind of the industry average, and I'm having trouble deciding what to weight.
Because just add up the operating income of all the companies, add up the investment capital of all the companies.
I was definitely thinking about doing that way.
Unless you can clean that out, so basically, you want to do that, take it out of the operating income and the investment capital.
Okay.
If you have that information, you can take it out. You just aggregate the numbers.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hi,
afternoon, evening, something. Okay. So here's what we're going to start with today. We're going to start with a couple of closing pieces on the risk-free rate. And we're going to talk a lot about equity risk premium, starting today, probably spilling over to the next session. So today's start of the class test is going to be about those two concepts. Before I go there, though, I did post my Petrobras valuation with a blog post. If you get a chance, take a look at it, because it is a very different company than Uber. A very different, I know it already, it's an oil company. It's very different psychologically, and here's why. It's always fun to value growth companies, because you can be optimistic, you can think about great things, so you make leaps into the future, you put a big growth rate. It is a little depressing valuing a company like Petrobras right now. Because everywhere you look, your exits are shut off, and you're in the middle of a fire. So it is actually psychologically a lot more difficult to value a company which is being closed in on, which is what Petrobras is. So again, it's for that. As we go through this class, I'm going to be jumping from one type of company to another. I haven't even thought of what to value next week. I don't even think till about Monday of the next, so next Monday I'll think of what to do next week. But I want to try to make it as different from Uber and Petrobras as possible. So if you get a chance, do play with the numbers. And that's all I want you to do. Open it up, look at the spreadsheet for about 5 or 10 minutes, tweak a few numbers. If that's all the time you have, move on. Okay? So please get a sense of what numbers are driving the valuation. So we talked about risk-free rates last session. Any questions on the mechanics of what we talked about? So basically we talked about why risk-free rates vary across currencies. We said it's inflation. And how, if you do things right, you should get the same value for a company no matter which currency you pay to do the valuation. So let's bring that to two closing questions. Let's assume you're looking at a multinational, which is almost every company now is in some level a multinational. Let's make it a Swiss multinational. You could put a name on it if you want, if that makes you feel better. Call it Nestle if you want. Let's assume that the company gets 10% of its revenues in Switzerland, and the cash flows are in Swiss francs, 30% of its revenues in the EU, and let's say the cash flows are in euros, 40% of the revenues in the US, where the cash flows are in US dollars, and 20% of its revenues in India, where the cash flows are in rupees. You're the CFO of the company. You're trying to decide what risk-free rate to use in valuing your company. And I'll give you the choice. And with each one, think about whether this is the right risk-free rate. You could use a simple average of the risk-free rates because you have four different currencies. I've given you risk-free rates in all four. It could take a simple average. You could take a weighted average based on how much of your revenues you get from each one. You could take the Swiss franc rate. Why? Because you're a Swiss company and you feel that you should always pick the local currency rate. You could pick the lowest of the rates. Why? Because you want to be conservative or whatever. You could pick the highest of the rate. Actually, if you pick the lowest, you get too low a cost of capital. If you want to get a really low cost of capital, or to be conservative, you can pick the highest of the rates. Or maybe the answer is none of the above. Let's take the first two choices, averaging. Is that okay? We average lots of things. Why shouldn't we average risk-free rates? You're going to face this because I see people averaging risk-free rates all the time. Okay? So why shouldn't you average risk-free rates? Perry, try.
Why shouldn't you? Because that might not be. It might not.
The minute you say the word "might," you're giving me an opening because then it's okay. Might is a weak word, so maybe I can slide in this way.
It's not taking into account the risk of certain operations in those different.
First, remember, a risk-free rate should never carry the burden of carrying. So first, risk-free rate is not meant to do that anyway, right? So you don't, that's, so the risk-free rate, which truly risk-free, has nothing to do with risk. It's got to do with the metric you've chosen to denominate things. In fact, let me give you a little experiment. What's the temperature in New York today? Let me ask you, what's the temperature today?
30.
Fahrenheit?
Yeah.
Okay. What's the temperature? Anybody from Europe or Latin America who thinks in Celsius? Okay, what's the temperature today in New York?
3.
So I've got two estimates of the temperature, 30 plus 3. I'm going to add the two up, divide by 2, and say the temperature is roughly 16 and a half. It doesn't make sense because that's like you giving your weight in pounds and him giving his weight in kilograms, and I'm adding the two and dividing by 2. It's not going. That's the problem with adding across risk-free rates. I'm adding apples and oranges and grapes and pineapples and throwing them all in. It's some kind of a fruit there. You are right, it's some kind of a fruit, but it's nothing that I recognize. So you know what the right answer is? It's not the Swiss franc rate. You can't automatically jump to the local currency.
Is it whatever currency you think the value?
Exactly. Never ever answer the question about risk-free rates until you get the other side of the picture. So if I'm valuing Nestle in Swiss francs, the risk-free rate is a Swiss franc risk-free rate. If I'm valuing it in euros, the risk-free rate is a euro risk-free rate. If I'm valuing it in Indian rupees, my risk-free rate is an Indian rupee risk-free rate. But it'll never, ever be an average across the numbers, because then I'm in deep trouble. You see, what if I don't want to mix currencies? Here's a second choice. You can keep this company as four separate regional companies, right? You can take its Swiss operations, estimate cash flows in Swiss francs, discount them at a Swiss franc risk-free rate. You could take the euro operations, estimate the cash flows in euros, discount them back at a euro cost of capital. The Indian operations at the rupee. And once you value the four pieces, you can then bring them all together. And then the conversion is easy. Use today's exchange rate. And you can tell me the value in Swiss francs or euro. So that's an option, but you can't have a combined company in four different currencies and allow some kind of a weighted risk-free rate to play around. Everybody comfortable with that? So that's the explanation you're going to have to give to somebody who says, hey, we're taking weighted averages with risk premiums. We're going to do that. Why shouldn't we do the same thing for risk-free rates? Because with risk-free rates, you really are talking about different metrics, different measurement devices, and you can't add them together in one assessment. Now let's talk about risk premiums. Yes?
Can you explain again why you would get the same valuation if you use different risk-free rates, like based on different...
Patrick, you want to answer that question? The question was, how come we get the same valuation? It's actually very simple. You got it. I'll help you along as we go along. If I pick a low inflation currency, where do I benefit? I have a lower discount rate. My discount rate is lower, right? But if I have a low inflation currency, where do I get hurt? When I do my cash flows and I put a growth rate in, I have to put the same low inflation that helped me in my discount rate is going to give me lower growth in my cash flows. I switch to a high inflation currency.
The only difference between the risk-free rates is the
inflation. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. That's why if Apple's borrowing money in Swiss francs because the rates are low, it is doing an incredibly stupid thing. And it just did. I'm just not making it up. Why companies do these stupid things, I don't know. The new story, this is a company, $710 billion company, doesn't need the money, goes out and borrows $850 million in Swiss francs. And here's the explanation. The rates are really low. So that'll be like my saying, it's really warm in New York. So let's say it's a hot day in New York. I'm going to convert all the temperatures to Celsius, and it's much cooler now. Look, it's only 36 degrees. It makes absolutely no sense, but companies do this all the time. They compare absolute numbers across currencies. And of course, the low inflation currencies are always going to look cheap to you because they're low inflation. So that's the intuition. Of course, there are lots of edges you've got to deal with. So we'll come back and actually look at an actual company valuation. You're going to see this play out when you do the cash flows and the discount rates. Now we're going to talk about equity risk premiums. That's the other piece we're going to spend a lot of time on. And the way in which most people estimate a risk premium to use in valuation is they look at a historical risk premium. Sounds fancy, but here's what they do. They take a period of history. They look at what stocks did over that period. They look at what a risk-free investment, T-bonds or T-bills or whatever you decide to call risk-free, did over the period. They take the difference. It's called a historical risk premium. Now, when you do that, what are you already telling me about the future? That the past is a good predictor of the future. In fancy terms, you're believing in mean reversion, that things always revert back. Is that a good assumption?
No.
Well, if you're in a stable system, it's okay, right? But if there's a structural shift in the system, then you're in big trouble. I'm going to make a confession. Pre-2008, I used to allow people to use historical premiums, and I was okay with it. Post-2008, I'm going to try to talk you as best as I can out of ever using a historical premium. Now you see why 2008 is my dividing line? Structural shift. Whatever you think about 2008, it wasn't just another year. It changed the way we thought about markets. The minute you do that, mean reversion is a very dangerous game to play. But let's say you decide to play it. Lots of people do. And you now have to make a mechanical decision as to how far back in time you're going to go to get a historical premium. You see what I mean by that? Because I said over a period of time. You could go back just 1 year. Why? Because you want something that's updated, recent. You can go back last 5 years, maybe to get a little bit of averaging. Go back as long as you can get the data for, which in the U.S. could be 1926 or even 1871. I've seen Robert Shiller actually maintains a database that goes back to 1871. Maybe you're one of those people who believe that it's consistency above everything else. So if you're using a 10-year T-bond rate, you use a 10-year risk premium. Or maybe it's with betas. Maybe you're using a 5-year beta and you want to use... So basically, you're trying to match up the time period to either your risk-free rate or your beta estimation period. So five different choices. Let's take A and B. What's the problem with those? Don't think finance, think stat.
It's too short.
It's noisy. I'm going to show you the standard errors on these numbers, and you're going to be astonished by how much noise there is in stock prices. 1 year is a five years sounds like a lot of time, but in stock market history, it's not even a blink of an eye. It's a movement of an eyelash. Okay? You need incredibly long periods, which already means that D&E should never be the answer. There are three numbers you need in a cost of equity, a risk-free rate of beta and an equity risk premium. There are three separate numbers. You can go back 150 years for your risk premium, go back 2 years for your beta, and have a 10-year risk-free rate. You're not being inconsistent. There are three separate numbers, three different estimates you have to make. Nothing tells you that you have to be 10 years on each of them. And here's my final question. Let's say you compute a historical risk premium. Historical risk premium, the start of this year was 4.6%. Let's assume that this year is a really bad year for stocks. I don't want people tweeting out the modern predicts bad year for stocks. This is a pure hypothetical, right? I have this problem with real time, real class tweets are going out, and you know, sometimes people say, oh my God, I said that. Hey. So this is a hypothetical. Hey. I'm not predicting doom and gloom. I'm not Robert Shiller. Hey. So let's assume that next year turns out to be a horrible year. You can put whatever you want as horrible. Drop of 30% in the market. End of 2015, I ask you to compute a historical risk premium for the U.S. Just give me a sense of direction. Is that number going to be lower than 4.6%, which is what it is now, higher than 4.6%, or unaffected? What am I doing with the historical risk premium? I'm looking at what you actually made on stocks and comparing it to what you actually made on a risk-free investment. I've now thrown in a really bad year for stocks, right? So you know what's going to happen to your risk premium? It's going to go down. And do you see why that should make you really upset or worried? Because you have a 30% drop in the market, and I ask you, do you feel stocks are riskier? What's your gut reaction going to be? At the end of 2008, say, was this a good year for you? Do you think stocks are risky? You just say, of course they're really risky. And what am I telling you? Oh, because it was so risky, I'm going to let you use a lower risk premium in the future. That is a problem with historical risk premiums, is intuitively they always move in the wrong direction. After really good years in the market, when you're feeling stocks are not that risky, they actually go down to really bad, I'm sorry, really go, they go up. But after really bad years, they go down. Again, something to file away. One more thing to worry about when you look at historical premiums. You say, what choice do I have? I can't tell you what the stock will do, what the market will do next year. I'm going to give you an alternative today that you've seen in my corporate finance class, but I'm going to kind of let you reason your way to this to see what I'm going to try to do. Let's assume that I came to you with an investment, right? And I'm going to pick somebody here. Don't put the weight of the world on your shoulders. Don't worry. You're going to be okay. Give me whatever your gut answer is on this. I could come to you with an investment where I guarantee you a dollar every year in perpetuity. Don't give me this little thing, I won't be around in perpetuity. You hand it over to your children, they'll hand it over. So assume there's somebody around to collect it. Okay? It's a dollar with certainty every year in perpetuity. Guaranteed. How much would you pay for that now, Joe?
More than a dollar.
That's not telling me much. Better be more than a dollar because it's a dollar just next year. Sandy? You figure it out. So it's a U.S. dollar, so what's the risk-free rate right now? Let's round it up to 2%.
Okay. So
you got it. You're almost there. So how are you getting as a cash flow? $1 every year forever. What kind of cash flow is that if you get a cash? It's a perpetuity. What's the present value of a perpetuity? It's cash flow over R. So 1 divided by 0.02 is? 50. So you pay well over a dollar. You pay about $50 for a guaranteed investment. Now we can tweak around that. But that's what you'd pay for a guaranteed investment. Now, Sandy, I won't pick on you, but I'm going to come back with the same dollar in cash flow now. But now, instead of being guaranteed, I'm going to tell you that there's risk in it. How much risk? As much risk as the average risk company. And you can put in your minds whatever that risk is. First, would you pay $50 still for that investment? How much would you pay? Give me a number. Okay. She says 40. Here's what our equity risk premium is. You're getting a dollar a year. You're paying $40. So what's your expected, because you get the dollar every year, your expected return on stocks then is 2.5%, 1 over 40. Your risk-free rate was 2%. Your equity risk premium is 0.5%. If you'd given 20 as your answer, 1 over 20 is 5%. Your equity risk premium is 3%. You paid 10. You see where I'm going? You tell me what you pay for things. You're telling me what your risk premium is. This is the opening I'm going to use. Does the market tell me every day how much it's willing to pay for stocks? Every minute of every day, you look at the S&P 500. You're getting the biggest. The way I describe this is watch what I pay, not what I say. Because I can say whatever I want. If you ask me what's the risk premium, I can make up numbers, 83%, 65%. But then when I pay for something, that's a real message I'm delivering. That's all an implied premium is. I'm going to take the level of the index. Of course, it's a little messier because the cash flow is not a dollar every year in perpetuity. I have to project out the expected cash flows. I have to do a little internal rate of return. It's a little messier in terms of math, but the logic is exactly the same. So if you want to earn a high expected return on stocks, what do you need to do right now? Pay less for stocks up front. So as stock prices go down, expected equity risk premiums go up. As stock prices go up, equity risk premiums go down. And if you remember your bond math, it's exactly what you see, right? Higher bond prices, that's exactly the logic we're going to use. So that's really the insight we're going to use to kind of break out of the tyranny of a historical risk premium. But let's do one final test on risk-free rates because, yes, Joseph. No, you don't, because all you need is an expected value. The noise on an expected value is much smaller. The noise is actually in the actual returns on stocks. Right? The advantage of shifting to expected cash flows is there's noise around the cash flow, but it's not like you think there's going to be 80% growth in earnings. This is the S&P 500, so you basically get the averaging out. So you might think there's 7% growth, and I might think there's 4, but that difference is tiny relative to the noise you have when I ask you what the actual return will be in any given year.
Okay, so right? Built into the expectation.
Exactly. Yeah. It might be different if I took some really narrow index where there's a huge amount of disagreement, but these are the 500 largest market cap companies. The range is tiny. Okay? So you actually get an amazingly precise numbers once you start playing with the numbers. Okay? One final point, and this again is something you're going to encounter all the time. We're in strange times. We're in strange times because in every major currency, you look at what the risk-free rate is now. It's at a level that people haven't seen before. 2.17%, now it's actually less than 2% of the US dollar, less than 0.5% of the euro, less than 0.2% of the Swiss franc. And that makes people uncomfortable. So what they try to do is get rid of that discomfort by doing what we do in valuation all the time, is we have a number that's moving around. Why don't we use a normalized version of that number? So I'm going to play a little game on you. Let's assume that this is January 1st of 2015. You can make the game as of today if you want. T-bond rate is 2.17%. I think it's too low. So here's what I propose to do. I propose to replace the current T-bond rate with a normalized rate. And what that rate will really depend on how old I am. And I'm not being facetious. Normalized is in your mind. So if you're 65 years old, a normalized T-bond rate should be about 7%. If you're about 45, it's about 5%. If you're 25, you think a normalized rate is about 2.5%. You say, what are you talking about? Which already tells you that normalized is. So, but I replace the normalized rate with some higher number, 5 to 6%. So that's my first choice. The second is I use my current 10-year bond rate as my risk-free rate and do the rest of the valuation, saying this is what it is. I have to take what I get. See what my basic question is? Is it okay to normalize risk-free rates today? Again, this is a conversation you're going to have if you're in corporate finance or valuation, no matter where you go. Should we be normalizing? Because we do it on all the other variables. Why shouldn't we? Anybody want to try? Jordan, should we normalize risk-free rates?
I generally don't.
Tell me why.
Same reason I don't see it when we adjust.
Do you normalize earnings?
No.
Do you normalize returns on capital? Come on, you must be normalizing something, because you can't be just taking last year's numbers and everything, right? So if you have numbers jumping around, if you have a cyclical company, oil company, for instance. Okay, so you avoid entire sectors of the market where you have to normalize. But if your numbers moving around, we do normalize things all the time. Do you see what? If I'm playing devil's advocate, my question is, what is it about risk-free rates that makes them special? Why not, if you think that's too low, why not replace it with a more normal number? Gabriel? Let me help you along this way to the reason. If I used a 5% holding all else constant, what's going to happen to my cost of capital? It's going to go up, right? My cost of capital goes up, what happens to my value? It's going to go down. In fact, I'm probably going to find that the value is much lower than the price, which means I shouldn't buy the stock. And what am I going to do with the money? I'm going to invest in this T-bond that makes 5 to 6%. Good luck to you on that one. The risk-free rate is not a hypothetical. It's what I can make right now with the money that I will not be investing in the stock. What you think, I think, or what Paul Krugman thinks or Robert Shiller thinks is completely irrelevant, because this is an actual opportunity cost. And if the opportunity cost is 2%, guess what? That's what you have to take. You have to be a price taker on some things. And this is one of those things. You got to be a price taker. You're saying, but won't this make my valuation too high? Well, if the other numbers are all consistent, there are reasons why the risk-free rate today is as low as it is. And you're going to see one of the reasons. In fact, why is there? In fact, let me ask that to you, because this is another huge misconception that's swirling around. Why is the risk-free rate so low today? I mean, you've been reading about this every month. Yes, Patrick. I wish it were the answer, but if you read the Wall Street Journal every day, what do they say the reason for low risk-free rates today is? QE, QE1, QE2, Titanic, whatever you want to call it. It's a central bank, and how, basically, I took my youngest son into the Federal Reserve for a tour, and just to be a pain in the ass, I asked the person who was leading us, can you take us to the room where Janet Yellen sets the interest rates? I said, I've been reading in the journal about how she said, she must have a rumor. She has a lever that she comes in every morning, I'll make the T-bond rate 2.5% today. What's the only rate the Fed controls? The Fed funds rate. That's it, this tiny little rate that banks essentially borrow and lend to each other. That's it, there's no T-bill rate, T-bond rate. The Fed does not control interest rates. It tweaks them. In fact, I'll send you the link to this blog post that I put up about a year ago, where I called Ben Bernanke the Wizard of Oz. And I called him the Wizard of Oz for a very simple reason. The Wizard of Oz, for those of you who've seen the movie, had no power. His power came from the perception that he had power. So when the curtain went down, there went the wizard. The Fed's power to set interest rates comes from the perception that they have the power. You see, but the rates couldn't have been this low without the Fed. Let me show you a graph. It's a graph I keep with me whenever people get carried away with how central banks set interest rates. See this purple line? That's actually the T-bond rate, the 10-year T-bond rate. So I've just graphed it out across time. Then I took two numbers. I took the inflation rate, that's a green, and the GDP growth rate each year, and I added them up. Think of that as an intrinsic risk-free rate, because in a sense, as Patrick pointed out, it's expected inflation plus a real growth that goes into. Take a look at that graph. See the difference between the T-bond rate and that intrinsic rate? That's the Fed effect, and it is tiny. So why have interest rates been low for the last 5 years? The answer is very simple, because inflation has been really low, and real growth has been in the toilet. Which actually means that there's some very bad news in the bond market, if you believe it, because what's the bond market telling us right now? Even though people are extremely optimistic about economic growth, the job numbers came out last week, what's the bond market telling you? We don't believe it. It's actually one of the things we'll have to confront. What the bond market is signaling, what the equity markets are signaling, are pulling in different directions. One or the other, actually both are probably wrong. The question is, who's more wrong? So risk-free rates actually, it's not, so when I use a 2% T-bond rate, it's true my costs of capital are going to be lower, but you know what else is going to be lower? When I get to growth in perpetuity, when I use growth numbers, I have to be consistent with what I call my risk-free rate. And you're going to see this play out when we talk about nominal growth forever. I'm not going to let you play with that number and say, I think it's going to be 4% a year forever, because the minute you use a risk-free rate, you've kind of capped your growth rate at pretty much that number. So risk-free rates seem like they're a no-brainer. But actually think about them. There is a message there that you should not ignore when you do valuation about future growth, about future inflation, and that message should play out when you look at your cash flows. So let's talk about the equity risk premium. Intuitive, the equity risk premium is what you would demand over and above your riskless rate to invest in equities as a class. That's it. That's the thing to remember. It's not about a specific stock. It's about equities as a class. As I said, most people who estimate use a premium use historical data. And you can buy the data. Duff and Phelps has it. Ibbotson has it. Save the money. This is actually the most public database in the world. You can, in fact, on my website, I actually do it at the start of every year. You can go to the Federal Reserve, pull up most of the raw data you need, and do it yourself. So this is the most updated historical risk premium for the U.S., and I go back to 1928 because that's when my T-bond rate series starts. So, no. As I said, there are a few other data series out there that go back to 1871, but I go back to 1928. And I looked at three slices of history, and I get three very different risk premiums. I looked at T-bills and T-bonds, and I get two different risk premiums, depending on whether I go short-term or long-term. And I also looked at arithmetic averages and geometric averages. Somebody remind me again what the difference is. Arithmetic averages, what do? I just take 80 years, add them up, divide by 80. Geometric averages are compounded numbers. So basically, it looks at money earns money. So if I earn 10% the first year and I drop 10% the second year, I'm not back to zero. I actually end up below zero because money earns money. There's a compounding effect. So how far back do I go? T-bills or T-bonds, arithmetic or geometric averages. My equity risk premium for the U.S. could be any number ranging from 8% to 2.73%. And this is why I will never be an expert witness, because I can lie with a straight face and technically not lie. Right? You put me on the witness chair and say, what's the risk premium for the U.S.? You want a lower number? I'll give you the 2.73. Technically, it is a historical risk premium. You want a high number? I'll give you the 8. I'm not lying, technically. But these numbers are not all equally reliable because it's stat 101, right? When you compute an average, you're also supposed to report in brackets below that number what the standard error in your estimate is. See these numbers, 2.17, 2.0, those are my standard errors. So when I tell you the risk premium over the last 86 years is 4.6%, before you get too impressed with that number, the standard error in that number is 2.3%. So let's do some stat 101. If the historical premium is 4.6 and the standard error is 2.3, give me a 95% range on your equity risk premium. What's the significance of a 95% range? Plus or minus 2 standard errors, right? So what's my true risk premium? It could be anywhere from 0 to 9.2. Fat lot of good that does me in evaluation. And in case you're ever tempted to go with a 10-year risk premium, 2.73, you know what the standard error in that number is? 8.65%. I might as well have told you nothing. It's complete noise. You'd be amazed at how many emerging market company valuations I see where people use historical risk premiums for Brazil or India or China using 20 years of data. And you say, what are you using? 20 years. Sounds like a lot, because in chronological time, 20 years is a lot of time. But in stock market time, 20 years is nothing. It's pure noise. So if you're going to use a historical premium, you've got to go back way, way, way back in time. In fact, it's been estimated you need about 150 to 200 years of uninterrupted market history where the market's not changing. See why that's significant as well? You say, why don't you go back to 1871? In 1871, the U.S. was an emerging market coming out of the Civil War. So I got more data, but I'm getting a different market. There's no way out of this box. In fact, this particular number has two problems. One is this noise problem, the standard error I talked about. The other is what I'm going to call a survivorship bias problem. A lot of people use risk premiums, tend to use US data because it's the longest, you can get clean data, you can go back in time. You're saying, so what? It's a lot of data. You know what the most successful market of the 20th century was? It's actually the US. So what have we done? We've taken the most successful equity market of the 20th century, we've extracted an equity risk premium from that market, and what do we say? When I invest in equities for the next 100 years, I'm going to get the equity risk premium of the best performing market of the next 100 years. But how do you know which one that is? You can't be US-centric in this because it's not a, it's just, a, you didn't pick the country randomly. You picked a country because you have long data series, and it happened to be one of the best markets of the 20th century. For a long time, we kind of waved our hands about it, said we can't do this, you know. But starting about 15 years ago, a couple of professors at the London Business School started estimating equity risk premiums for about 15 to 20 markets. In fact, it's one of the great data series out there. You can buy the data if you're interested. If you really want to use historical risk premium, my suggestion is you get that data because it actually gives you historical risk premiums across all the markets. So the way to read this is these are the historical risk premiums for stocks versus short-term governments, so the equivalent of a T-bill, and long-term governments, equivalent of a T-bond for different markets. And you can see there are markets like, you know, I don't know what the worst performing market is, but I guess it's Denmark, okay, which have really low risk premiums. Markets like South Africa where the premiums are much higher. And what this particular study actually does, which is interesting, is it gives you an average equity risk premium across all 20 markets. See what, why that's, if you're going to use a historical risk premium, you want to get across good, because you don't know for the next 100 years what the best market is going to be. You can't presuppose that you've picked the best market already, because if you can do that, why are you wasting your time doing valuation? Just pick the market, pick the equity index, you're going to make a lot of money. So this premium that you're getting is a historical premium, and that's a world number. So if you believe this data, the historical risk premium is not 4.6, it's closer to 3.3%. So basically, I'm looking at the world premium. So the green number is the number of bonds. You're saying, why are you looking at bonds? Because my risk-free rate always is a long-term rate. I don't care about T-bills. I care about the premium over T-bonds. Now, remember last session I talked about 10 years versus 30 years? If you decide to go with a 30-year bond, here's the problem you run into. The 30-year bond has not been around since 1928, so you don't get the data. So you actually have to do something to adjust this risk premium for the fact that you've now shifted away from a 10-year bond rate to a 30-year bond rate. And that's why I said for convenience, I'm going to stick with a 10-year bond because the rest of the assessments get a little easier. Any questions on historical risk premiums? So now let's talk about the difficult countries. At least for the US, it's luxury of riches. Do I go back to 1928 or do I go back to 1871? One nice thing about being in Bolivia is you don't have to ask this question. You're not going to be able to go back to 1928, 1978, or maybe even 1998. You have 4 years of data, take it or leave it. And many emerging markets, that is a problem you face. Is what do I do about estimating an equity risk premium in the market because historical premiums are not going to work. You don't have enough data. So I'm going to take you through three different ways of estimating risk premiums. Two of them you've probably already seen in corporate finance, but might as well remind you. The first, and this is the conventional way in which most banks and consulting firms estimate risk premiums for other markets, is they take a US premium, which they might estimate using historical data, and they add the default spread for a country to that risk premium. Remember we talked about cleaning up risk-free rates last session by taking out the default spread? That's exactly why I took out the default spread, because if you don't, you'd have left the default spread in that government bond rate, and you'd have added a default spread to your equity risk premium. But if you take it out, you can then say, okay, I'm going to bring it back. And that's why I said don't ponder too much about the right default spread, because if you take out too low a number there, you're going to be basically putting in a too low a number for your risk premium as well. So as an example, in January 2015, the spread was 1.55, 2.86, or 1.9%. Take your pick. Take that default spread. Add that on to the risk premium for the US. Let's say it's 5.75%. I'll tell you why I use 5.75% in a few minutes. That's my mature market premium for 2015. I can add the default spread. Let's say it's 1.9. I pick the rating-based spread. And my equity risk premium for Brazil would be 7.65%. This is the state of the art, if you can even call it that. Play devil's advocate. Tell me what you find troublesome about what I'm doing here to get equity risk premium. Because I'm starting with the US base and I'm adding the default spread for a country, right? What is default spread measure? What is it? What was that extra return for? Basically, it was for buying a bond issued by the Brazilian government and saying they could default, right? But what are you trying to estimate here? Equity risk premium. So the first problem you have is, why am I using a bond spread if I want an equity risk premium? And the answer is very simple, because it's there. It's right in front of you. So people say, well, you know, what else can I do? I need a measure of country risk. Here it is right there. And you can use a CDS spread if you don't believe it. So basically, this just becomes, it's observable. I don't have any other.
So wouldn't you always be underestimating the...
Probably. And the reason, tell me why.
So if the debt is riskier by 1.9%...
Yeah, equity should be even riskier.
Exactly.
That's exactly the first question I asked. When I first saw this approach, I said, aren't you guys underestimating risk premiums because you're using a bond default spread when you really want an equity spread? I'll come back and deal with that, because I'm going to take you through a second approach. This is the Goldman approach for estimating equity risk premiums. And here's what they do. They take the US equity risk. All these approaches start out with the presumption you know the US premium. So if you screwed that up, everything's going to be screwed up on top of that. And then they look up two numbers. The standard deviation in the S&P 500, which measures the risk of the equity market for that 5.75% goes, and the standard deviation in the local market equity index. So, for instance, if I took Brazil, here's what the numbers look like. The standard deviation of the Bovespa, which is the Brazilian equity index, is 21%. The standard deviation of the S&P 500 is 18%. Let's set up an algebra problem. For the US market, which is a standard deviation of 18%, you demanded a 5.75% premium, right? If the Brazilian market has a standard deviation of 21%, which is roughly what? 16% higher than the US premium. You take 21 over 18, so that gives you the relative volatility of the Brazilian market multiplied by 5.75%. That measure would give you an equity risk premium for Brazil of 6.71%, which effectively means a country risk premium you're attaching for Brazil is the difference between that and 5.75. This looks much better, right? More logical. But it rests on two numbers. Standard deviation in the S&P 500, which should be relatively soon. You can get it out of the options, you can get it out of historical data, and the standard deviation in the local equity index. You know what its weakest link is? The standard deviation in the local equity index. Is that going to be high for risky countries and low for safe countries? And what might get in the way? Liquidity is a big deal. In fact, let's take the extreme scenario. I remember reading an article in the Wall Street Journal a long time ago about the Egyptian stock market. I don't know whether this is still true. But the way trades were recorded, there was a guy in front of the exchange with a chalkboard, and he would write each trade as it happened. And he wouldn't fill up the chalkboard by the end of the day. You'd get five trades over the whole day. If your trading volume goes towards zero, what's the standard deviation of equity in your stock going to go towards? What do we measure standard deviation based on? Change in prices. For prices to change, you need trading. So if liquidity goes towards zero, your standard deviation is going to go towards zero. You see what this approach will lead you to? It'll lead you to underestimate the equity risk premiums for illiquid markets. In fact, I do an annual update of these equity risk premiums, a bone-numbingly boring exercise, but I do it anyway just to keep myself on. And I actually take every market, I use the Goldman approach. And for Pakistan, for instance, last year, I got an equity risk premium of 3%. Total equity risk, not the country risk premium, an equity risk premium of 3%, much lower than the risk premium in the US. Why? Because there's almost no trading liquidity. So It's a much more logical approach, but the numbers that we're using are not giving us a sense of the true risk premium. So I'll give you my third approach, and this is the approach I use. It comes with its own load of baggage that you got to deal with. I took Dipendra's point about, hey, you're looking at the default spread. That's the risk in buying a government bond. I borrowed from the Goldman approach. But I, instead of looking at the standard deviation of the Bovespa against the U.S. equity index, I looked at the standard deviation of the Bovespa against the standard deviation of the Brazilian government bond. You're saying, isn't illiquidity a problem? It could still be, but what am I assuming? I'm assuming that if illiquidity is a problem in one market, it's probably going to be a problem in the other market as well. That might be a bad assumption. In Venezuela, for instance, it's become a really bad assumption because the government bond is actually much more liquid than the equity market is. But it doesn't give you as many false numbers as you do with the Goldman approach. So in this case, if you take the standard deviation, the Brazilian government bond, 14%, you take the default spread, 1.9%, you scale it up to reflect the fact that equities in Brazil are about 1.5 times more risky than bonds, and you get a risk premium for Brazil of 2.85%. You add that onto the 5.75%, your equity risk premium for Brazil is 8.6%. So pure default spread, relative equity market volatility, or bond default spread scaled up to reflect the risk of equities versus the government bond. There's a fourth approach, which actually has gone out of fashion, but for a while it was actually the default approach used. It was pushed by McKinsey in their first valuation book. And their argument was there is no country risk premium, that you should basically use one risk premium around the world. There's actually an internal logic that they use that made sense when they wrote that edition that no longer makes sense. It goes back to the point we made last session about diversifiable risk and non-diversifiable risk. Remember we talked about that? That risk you can diversify away does not show up in your discount rate. So 1986, when McKinsey made the argument, Coca-Cola for a long time used 12% cost of capital everywhere in the world. And they used the McKinsey book as their basis. So what's McKinsey implicitly saying about country risk when they said, don't worry about it, that it's diversifiable? Yeah. But that's an empirical question, right? For country risk to be diversifiable, what has to be true about the correlation across countries? It doesn't have to be zero, but it has to be low. And in 1986, if you drew a correlation matrix across countries, that's what you saw. What happened in Brazil had nothing to do with what happened in India. In fact, they probably didn't even read about the Bovespa in India, because you're probably reading the local newspaper. So in 1986, there was a basis for the McKinsey argument. But then we sold everybody on globalization. Investors got sold on it. Companies got sold on it. And by the time you get to the late 90s, and definitely into the last decade, as you look at the correlation matrix across countries, what do you start seeing? They start to rise. In fact, in 2008, if you remember, it was across the globe. The correlation was like 94%. Now do you see why McKinsey had to rewrite that section? Because that argument, it took them a while to catch on. It until their 2005 edition, they kept saying what they said in the 86 edition until one day they woke up and said, it's not working anymore. But if you have people saying country risk is diversifiable, don't dismiss it off the bat. Say, okay. Lead them through the process. What has to be true for country risk to be diversifiable? Well, the correlations have to be low. If you can, print off a correlation table across countries, because that's all you need. This is an empirical question. It's not a theory question of he said, she said. This is really a question of can you really diversify away? And I firmly believe you no longer can, that there is a country risk component that cuts across, that if Sao Paulo has problems, you actually see Mumbai go down. We're connected in ways we don't want to be connected, but welcome to globalization. Okay? So the start of every year, I go through this exercise. My first week every year is my data week. I call it my Moneyball week. It's a week where you've read Moneyball, right? If you're in valuation, you have to read Moneyball. You at least watch the movie. If you can't read anymore, that's fine. I've forgotten how to read. Watch the movie, right? Great movie. Because what was the movie about? It was about the fact that baseball was run all by these rules of thumb, right? The scouts would come in and say, that guy has a lot of whip on his left hand, And he said, okay, he's been around six, the scout has been around 55 years, he must know what he's... And until Billy Bean came along and said, why am I listening to this 85-year-old guy who can't even see the field anymore? Tell me what's going to go on. I'm just going to look at the numbers. And we get, in valuation and corporate finance, we start to believe our own stories, our own rules of thumb, this mythology that goes on, this is good, this is bad, and then we reason our way to the, this is, should be, and I'm as guilty as everybody else because I can reason my way, this is what you should do. But the numbers are a reminder to me that what I think should happen is not always what happens. So the first week I collect the data. So I do it for a lot of, so the 41,000 companies. So we'll talk a little bit about how that plays out and how I think about betas and risk premiums and risk-free rates. But I do this update for country risk premiums. Now part of you is saying, well, I'll never be valuing a Nigerian company. Who cares? You're valuing ExxonMobil? You better start caring about Nigeria. Where again, connect to the hip. We have to think about risk around the world. So this is actually the table that it's actually by far the most downloaded data set on my website. It has two things going for it. One is it's free. That's always a plus. And the second is it's transparent. Everybody can see what I'm doing. If they disagree with me, they can say I disagree with you. I allow them to change whatever they don't like. So this is my January 2015 equity risk premium update. It's all based on a starting point, which in the U.S. is 5.75%. That was in January. This month, if I updated this table, the base in the U.S. would be 6%. You say, what happened between January and February? In a little while, I'll talk about how that base number comes about. But that 5.75% you see showing up in a lot of countries, right? You see Canada has 5.75, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, Germany. What do they share in common? What am I using to come up with my risk premium? I start with the U.S., then I look at the default spread for your country, and then I scale it up, right? And what do I base the default spread on? I can look at the CDS market, or I can look at your rating. And if your rating is AAA, what do? I treat you as default free. I give you the U.S. risk premium. It's as simple as that. If your rating is not AAA, then I go through the process of what's your default spread, how do I scale it up. So it's a very, very simple adaptation of what I did for Brazil on the previous page across countries. So I have a risk premium by country. And I think in my most recent update, I have it for 141 countries. 67 of them also CDS spreads. So I let you use the CDS spread instead if you don't like ratings agencies and what they do. There are 141 countries that either Moody's or S&P rates. There are about 18 countries, I will confess, that are not on my list. And if you're thinking about investing in them and you ask them what kind of risk premium should I use, my answer is a really high number. Because here are some of the countries you won't see on my list. Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq. I think Syria is still there. I think Syria might be, oh yeah, Syria is off the list. So it's basically what I call frontier markets. I actually tried this year to do the frontier markets. If you get a chance, go and visit the spreadsheet. I had to get really creative to come up with it. But I think if you gave me a country and say, what's the risk premium to use, I can at least give you a reasonable starting point to go on. Okay? But basically, the approach I'm using to get it is exactly the approach that I just described. Any questions on the mechanics here? Yes. Give me a country
like
that you
Botswana at 1.28%,
or take the Middle East. I'll give you the answer. Take the Middle East. Notice how all the risk premiums are really low. Saudi Arabia, almost nothing, right? What's causing it? What's my basis for country risk? Your rating, which is based on how much you borrow. How much does Saudi Arabia borrow? Nothing. They have no default risk, but that doesn't mean they don't have equity risk, and that's, I think, the flaw with any default risk-based approach. Is if you're a country with low default risk, then you're going to end up with this low equity risk premium. What I'm, of course, missing is the fact that the equity risk here comes from these potentially catastrophic political events that are not captured there. So that's, I think, the weakness of any default spread-used approach. And every year I try to find ways to get around that, but it's really tough. When you leave the bond market, it's very difficult to get measures of country risk. There are the World Bank and PRS come up with country risk scores, but they're very difficult to convert into percentage spreads. But that's why a country like Botswana might have a low risk premium is because they don't borrow money, their rating is really good. If the rating is really good, then the I also report regional averages. And the way I compute the regional average is I take a weighted average of the equity risk premiums of the countries in that region, weighted by the GDP. And the reason I do that is if I took Asia and I took China and Vietnam and treated them as equivalent or equal, I'm really not being fair. If you invest in Asia, my guess is you get more revenues from China than you do from Vietnam. So the regional weighted averages are GDP weighted averages. Question? But because if you tell me, and here's the reason I do that. If you tell me where your revenues are by country, I'm just going to use the country. Some companies, though, don't give you revenues by country. They give you revenues by region. So Apple might say we get 27% of our revenues from Asia. And when they say that, my presumption is they really get most of their revenues from China. And if I use an equity risk premium that's a simple average, I'm going to be acting like they get as much revenues from Vietnam as they do from China. So it's the logic of when companies aggregate revenues by region, odds are they're getting more of their revenues from the bigger countries in the region. So if you're telling me you get a lot of revenues from Latin America, my guess is you're getting a lot more from Brazil than you are from Bolivia. Okay? So that's why I do the regional averages, but I also report a simple average if you prefer to work with that. But what I'd really like are country-by-country breakdowns. So this is really my technique for dealing with companies that don't give me full information. Okay. Any other questions? So now let's close the loop. Yeah.
Can I just go back to risk-free rates?
Yeah.
You said that we should be like a price taker for risk-free rates, but like let's say you have a model right now, and then you update it a week later, and your risk-free rate, for whatever reason,
changes. Why a week later? You could have done the valuation at 9:30 this morning.
Yeah,
by 4 o'clock this evening, the value is going to be different. But remember, what are you tracking? You're not tracking the value. You're tracking the value versus the... What do you compare the value to as an investor? The price. So if interest rates move a lot between 9:30 and 4, it's true the value will change over the day, okay, but so will the price. So rather than think about, hey, this is really uncomfortable, my value keeps changing all the time, because it will, think about the value versus the price, because if you found the stock to be undervalued in the morning and it's still undervalued in the evening, you're okay. But then you have to, so the cases you have to worry about is when you get that shift from value, and that's your opportunity, because you might start off the day with a stock being overvalued, interest rates move up, and the market for whatever reason overreacts on a particular stock and knocks the price down too much. There's your chance to step in.
And should you also adjust, like let's say risk-free rates went up, and you think it's because like inflation expectations or GDP growth expectations changed, so now you should also like adjust the
value? Yeah, everything in your valuation has to be tied to whatever. So these are not individual numbers. They all tell a story, and the story is connected somewhere. Okay? That's why in a valuation you can't keep everything else constant, change one number, because that's not the way the world works. Yeah. It depends, right? Because did everybody get the point? Because the conventional wisdom is holding all else constant. If risk-free rates go up, value goes down. You're right. But if risk-free rates go up for the right reason, you could actually benefit from that. And that's why when people freak out, what if the T-bond rate goes to 4%? It might be the healthiest thing on the face of the earth. You know why? Because if it reflects the fact that we're really finally out of that 2008 crisis cycle, maybe our risk premiums will now be lower. Maybe our growth will be much higher. And our values could be much higher. It's a great trick. So when you are on the other side of the interviewing, when you want to torture other people rather than be tortured, this is a great question to ask. If interest rates go up, will stock prices go down? Okay. It's not always clear, right? So now let's talk about bringing this into your valuation. So I have my risk premiums for 150 countries. I now come to you with a company. And you can put a name on the company. Give me the company you picked in your valuation. Here are the three approaches for bringing it into your discount rate. In the first, you take your expected return as a risk-free rate plus beta times mature market premium. And that could be US or whatever you decide to use. And then you add a country risk premium as a constant. That's the first approach. In the second, the country risk premium, instead of being a constant that you add on to the company, you put into the brackets and multiply by the beta. Very subtle difference, right? Because if your beta is 1, approaches 1 and 2 will give you the same answer. But if your beta is higher than 1 or lower than 1, the two approaches will give you different answers. And in the third approach, which is the most generic one, here's what you do. You take the risk-free rate plus beta times mature market premium. And then you take the country risk premium and you treat it as a second factor. What I mean by a second factor is beta measures how exposed you are to macroeconomic risk, right? If you believe that your exposure to country risk is different from your exposure to macroeconomic risk, and we'll talk about why that might be for some companies, you might decide to separate it out and use, that should be a lambda, I think that's a lambda in your notes, something like a beta, but it'll be different. So basically you can say my company has very little exposure. Electrobras, for instance. Somebody sent me the suggestion that I should value Electrobras next week. I'm not going to do it. Brazil is done for this for the next 3 weeks. I have to move to a different continent. But he said Electrobras is a regulated utility. It's, you know, so it looks cheap to me. You know. But if you took Electrobras, it probably has a pretty low beta because it's a required product. You know, the beta should be low. But could have a very high exposure to country risk because you have this government interference or political effects in it. So that's a company where you might decide to separate it out and treat it separately. So constant, bring it into the brackets, or treat it as a separate factor with its own number. And in doing all of this, you have to make a decision. And this is going to be a big decision. When you think about the country risk for a company, you have to decide whether you're going to be location-based. Location-based in what sense? You're going to look at what country that company is incorporated in and give it that country risk premium. Or you have to decide whether your country risk premium should be based on operations. I'm not going to beat around the bush here. I believe that location-based country risk premium is a disaster. You see what I'm, why? If I gave you Coca-Cola, you say, well, it's a U.S. company. I don't have to worry about country risk, really. What about Nestle? Oh, it's a Swiss company. I don't have to worry about country risk. Then I give you Embraer, it's a Brazilian company. I have to worry a lot about country risk. You know that Embraer gets more of its revenues in the U.S. than Coca-Cola does? The way I see it is we have global companies that through the accident of history happen to be incorporated in all these different countries. So I think it's a no-brainer. But unfortunately, the default is risk premium is still based on where you incorporate rather than where you do business. So I'm going to push for an operation-based country risk premium. It's easier for some companies than others, and I'll give you two examples. In 2004, I was valuing Embraer. Everybody familiar with Embraer? If you've taken a short-haul flight in the U.S., you probably were flying an Embraer or a Bombardier jet. So they have these 40, 50-person passenger planes. Very well-run company. Okay. And in 2004, it got 97% of its revenues in the U.S. and Western Europe, in developed markets. 3% of its revenues in Brazil. So if you ask me what the equity risk premium for Embraer is, I could freak out about the fact that it's a Brazilian company or step back and say, that's really not true. It is really a global company that gets a small percent of revenues. So the risk premium I'd have used in 2004 for Embraer would have been 97% times a mature market premium plus 3% times a country risk premium. I'll tell you that there is a, by focusing on revenues, I am opening myself up to a danger. And I'll come back and talk about this. Okay? And I'll talk about why I'm so revenue-focused in the first place. Not because I want to, but often because I have no choice. Right? But for the moment, kind of hang in there with the revenues. Much more complex company. If I took Ambev, another Brazilian-based company, which over the last decade has kind of expanded its operations all over Latin America, this is what it looks like. It gets about 64% of its revenues in Brazil and about 36% over the rest of Latin America. In fact, there's a little Canadian operation that it bought. The equity risk premium for Ambev would be a weighted average based on its revenues. You're saying, why are you staying so revenue focused? You open up an annual report. You look at what companies report about their geographical operations. The one number that they report consistently is revenues by country. Not even by country, by region at least. You know what? Why that worries me? And this is something we'll come back to. In fact, let me do the Coca-Cola and I'll come back to it. If you ask me to value Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola breaks its revenues down, but they don't break them down by country. They break them down by region. Their excuse is too many countries. But it does create a problem for me. Because when they say Western Europe, I'm hoping and praying it's not all in Greece. Right? You have no way of knowing. That's where that, this is where I have to kind of get down on my knees and say, please, 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 let it be distributed the same way the GDP is in this part of the world. But I have no choice. It's not my choice that they report it this way. And there are some U.S. companies that really piss me off. Here's what they report. We get 61% of our revenues in the U.S., 39% from the rest of the world. Come on, guys. The rest of the world is a really big place. Could you start being a little more specific about what exactly the rest of the world means? But you're going to face it with your company. You can't change it. That's the way it is. As investors, that's what you face. You've got to deal with that and move on. So don't do valuation in the world you wished you were in. Do valuation in the world you're in, and the world you're in, this is what they give you. And here's my problem with revenues, and this is what I think Deependra was going to raise. I told you Embraer gets very little of its revenues in Brazil, right? So the equity risk premium I used for Embraer was tiny. But you know what am I missing when I do that?
Whole cost structure.
Their operations are all in Brazil, right? So if Brazil goes to hell in a handbasket, I'm going to go down with it. So the problem with focusing on revenues is I'm missing the fact that your risk might not be where you get your revenues, it might be where you generate your operations. That's why when I look at an annual report, I try to see if I can get some information on where their factories are. Very few companies are forthcoming about it. I can try to find it from other sources, but that's something that kind of concerns me about revenue-based exposures. But I'm looking for it, whatever information I can. And the question also is, should I be adjusting that exposure? Because beta is carrying a lot of weight on its shoulders now, right? Not only is it measuring exposure, now I'm asking you to measure. So those two prompts of this approach kind of make me a little uncomfortable. So let me talk a little bit about becoming more refined in thinking about why some companies are more exposed to country risk than others. The first is, the revenues do matter. Where you sell stuff is interesting to me. But the second also is, where do you have all your factories? I'd like to know where your factories are in Brazil. Are they half in Brazil and half in Venezuela, in which case I'm really freaking out. Right? I'd also like to know whether you're managing your risk. Have you bought insurance against some of this risk? Because that's going to play into my valuation. And here's the thing that potentially should scare you if you're valuing a company. If the government claims you're in the national interest, you've just become much more exposed to country risk. Because you know what that effectively means, right? You see the Petrobras effect. They get the license to come in and say, you can't do this, don't touch it. So essentially, they feel this urge to meddle in everything because it's a national interest. I'll add one final thing, which is, if you're in the national interest and you have, it's one thing to have your manufacturing facilities in a country and be exposed to it, but what if you're operations are in a country and you really can't move them. You can say, well, manufacturing company, take your factory, put it elsewhere. But if you're a natural resource company, you are completely and totally exposed, right? So what are you going to do if you're Petrobras? You don't like the Brazilian government? You're going to pull up your reserves out of Brazil, take them to Miami? It doesn't work that way. Natural resource companies, in my view, are much more exposed to country risk precisely for that reason. When I value oil companies, rather than weight the equity risk premiums by where they get their revenues, which is kind of meaningless, they all sell into a dollar oil market, a global oil market, I actually look at where the reserves are. And with oil companies, you can actually get that and take a weighted average. So those companies that have the bulk of their reserves in Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Russia, they're in big trouble. So be pragmatic. None of these is an ironclad rule that you can use in every company. Be pragmatic. Make your best judgment on how to measure country risk. Yeah.
Let's say you had a company like Embraer, and we had country by country revenues and the costs. Like, what would you do then?
Be pragmatic. So you want to weight them all both equally, go ahead. But if you say, you know what, then
like
it depends on how much flexibility you have. How the problem with aerospace companies is when if you've seen one of those plants that Boeing builds, it's like miles. It's very difficult to move these things once you put them there. So with an aerospace company, you say, I'm kind of like a natural resource company, so I'm going to wait where you have your factories and 60% of your revenue is 40%. This is why it is. Okay. If you're Infosys, you know what Infosys does, right? They're software engineers in a building in Bangalore. If they feel that India is going to go to hell in a handbasket, they get three old Boeing 747s. They put all the software engineers on them. They send them off, I don't know where. Okay. Much more easy for them to deal with it. So if you gave me operating breakdown for Infosys, I might say it's 90% revenues, 10% operations. So be pragmatic. Make up your rules as you go along. That's a great thing about valuation. This isn't accounting. I'm not going to say this, and this. You can't break that. As long as you're pragmatic and you essentially back up what you're doing, that's all you can really do. Okay? Any other questions on country risk? So let me talk a little bit about Lambda. So yeah.
Does the enforcement of property rights factor into this at all? Like if there's
government, yeah, you could argue it's enforcement of property rights, it's how good is the legal system, all of those things play into country risk, right? So you could argue that countries like China are a lot riskier than they look from a default risk perspective because your property rights. In a country like Russia, you don't have property rights. You might think you do, but you don't.
So since those aren't factored into your numbers, would you add?
You're hoping and praying that the ratings say that there is a correlation between the rating and that. If it isn't, then you've got to come up with some other way of capturing it.
Okay.
Now let me talk a little bit about lambdas. Lambda is a measure I concocted. Notice the word I use, I didn't say derived, because that suggests deep thought. I concocted on a flight to Brazil about a decade ago. So the way it would work is I'd get on a plane in Newark or JFK, and I'd take this flight to Sao Paulo, and I'd teach the day, and I got in. It's kind of a mess, because you get into Sao Paulo, you get in the airport, that's one thing. Getting into the city is an entirely different game altogether. It could be 6 hours before you get there. Now, so it's a long flight. I was sitting next to this really, I don't know what he had, some kind of fidgeting disease. You know, he was moving around. I couldn't go to sleep. So I, you know, pull up my presentation for the next day. I'm browsing through it. And I was using the conventional approach, which is, treating Embraer and Ambev as Brazilian companies. This was the moment of epiphany when I said this doesn't work. Because I'd treated them both as Brazilian companies attached as big risk premium. And I had Embraer's annual report and I was going through it. And I looked and they got 3% of the revenues in Brazil and Ambev was getting 90%. I also happened to have, don't ask me why I was having all these annual reports in my backpack. It must have been my annual. So I had Boeing's annual report, and I had the pie chart for Boeing and the pie chart for Embraer, and I put them next to each other, and I could not tell which was which. Unless you put the label on top, because they look very much alike. They both look like they sold a lot of stuff in the U.S. and Western Europe, and a little bit of stuff in Brazil. So I said, you know what? What we're doing doesn't work. So I said, we need a measure of company exposure to country risk. And I decided to call it Lambda because I've discovered that if you attach a Greek alphabet to something, it adds a layer of sophistication that makes the intimidation. The only people who are not impressed by this are the Greeks. They think the option trade has already stole their alphabet, which is true. And here you are coming along, falling. So I'm taking your alphabet too. So it was purely selfish. I called it Lambda because I thought if I called it L, people say that's not sophisticated, but Lambda, they kind of back off. So I said, we have, and I decided to call it Lambda. And then I went to sleep, in spite of the fidgety guy next to me. I wake up in Sao Paulo, I start teaching. I'm underwater, but in Brazil you can drink those little cups of espresso. It's like taking drugs in, like six cups of those. You can stay awake for like 6 days. So around 3 o'clock, I bring this issue up. I said, wouldn't it be nice if we had a measure of company risk exposure that captured that embed. And people agreed it was a good idea, but then one of the more practical people in the audience says, well, that's nice, but how do you plan to measure this Lambda? And I said, I haven't thought about that yet, but I have a long trip back. And actually, on that trip back, I wrote a paper that's on my website, an estimating Lambda, another incredibly boring paper that if you feel the urge to read, you should, which talks about what are the different things that should go into company risk exposure, what are the different ways of measuring Lambda. The most simplistic way is revenue-based. You tell me that you get, in this case, Tata Motors and Tata Consulting Services. Tata Motors was getting 91% of its revenues in India, and that was just before they bought Land Rover Jaguar. So that's different now. And Tata Consulting Services gets about 8% of its revenues. And I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the percentage of revenues you get domestically, and I'm going to divide it by what the average company in this country gets domestically. And already your mind is going, how the heck am I going to get the number? We'll come. I'll tell you a way to cheat. Okay? And I'm going to come up with a measure of lambda. So based on that, the lambda for Tata Motors is 1.14. The lambda for Tata Consulting Services is 0.09. Very simplistic, based on revenue. And of course, the Achilles heel here is, how the heck do you get an average across? I'll tell you the long way to do it. Go into Bloomberg, pull up each company, get the percentage of revenues in India for each company. Do it at least for the Sensex. It's really not that much work. If you're too lazy to do it, I'll give you a second suggestion. Don't take it out of this room. Here's what I did. Because I had to do this for every country in the world. And there is no way I'm going to go pull up each company's. You can't even pull it off Capital IQ because it's kind of in a, hidden away. So I went to the World Bank. And I looked at their export statistics, the percentage of GDP for each country that comes from exports. You see how I'm going to cheat now? You tell me that 23% of your GDP comes from exports, here's what I assume. The typical company in this country gets 77% of its revenues domestically, 23% overseas. You don't like it? And you can go collect all the data on individual companies and tell me why I'm wrong, but at least the onus is on you. So, it's a very simplistic measure. I'll send you the link to the World Bank site. The World Bank has a lot of data, but the problem is it's like going through thousands of pages of useless stuff to find something that actually matters. So I'll actually send you the direct link so you can find this. But that's the lambda. The problem, as I said, of course, it's entirely revenue-based. Whereas you know that what you want is a measure of country risk that's richer. You want to see the effect on cash flows and earnings and growth. So here's my other suggestion. You know how we estimate betas, right? We run a regression of returns in the stock against returns in the market index. The slope of the line is the beta. So what you're capturing is, how sensitive is my stock to changes in the overall market index? What are we trying to measure in country with lambda? How sensitive is my company to changes in country risk, right? That's what lambda is. So I ran a regression of returns on Embraer, in this case, two Brazilian stocks, Embraer and Embratel, against returns on a C bond. You're saying, what the heck is a C bond? That was a dollar-denominated Brazilian bond. And you know what it captures? When Brazil has a bad day, guess what happens at bond? The returns are negative. So essentially what I was trying to find out was, when Brazil has a bad day in the country bond market, what happens to your stock price?
I'm sorry?
The chart. It's not that fascinating. You know? But essentially what you're looking for is how sensitive. In fact, today you have an easier task, right? Instead of the C bond, what could you use as your measure of changes on day-to-day on country risk? Somebody mentioned CDS spreads. Was it you that mentioned CDS spreads last week? Last session, somebody did. Do you mention CDS spreads? You could run this against CDS spreads. See how they... Basically, intuitively, what am I trying to capture? I'm saying, hey, if country risk expands, is your company affected? Not at all, in which case your lambda is very low, or a lot, in which case your lambda is high. Now, I took Embraer and Embratel. Don't read too much into this. But based on these regressions, every 1% change in the dollar-denominated bond, Embraer's returns change only 0.27%. It's only 0.27 times as exposed as the typical company. Embraer, which is a phone company with all of its assets in Brazil with a tremendous government interference factor, every 1% change in the bond translates. So the lambda for Embraer would be roughly 2, and the lambda for Embraer would be 0.27. It's a lot of work to do this. I do this only if I absolutely have to. There is no way I'm doing this for Coca-Cola. You know why? How many lambdas would I have to run? 72 lambdas. There is no way I'm even going there. So this is really an approach you use for when you have a single emerging market exposure that you're worried about, that you want to estimate the lambda for. So if I took Embraer and I plugged in the numbers in 2004. So basically what I mean by plugging in the numbers is I looked at assuming what people do, constant risk exposure and adding the entire Brazilian risk premium, which gives me really high cost of equity, 17 or 18%, or doing what I suggested, which is look at the fact that Embraer is a Brazilian company in name, but it's really a global company with most of its sales outside, I get about 10%. So much lower cost of equity if I use my approach and much higher. Carry this to the next step. Let's assume this half of the class is going to use a conventional approach to get cost of equity, in which case you're going to get 17 to 18% cost of equity. This half of the class is going to believe me, which is a dangerous thing, and go with the 9 to 10%. What are you going to find? You're going to come up with a low value. You're going to come up with a much higher value. Let's say the entire market thinks like that. So the price is going to be low because people say it's a Brazilian company. Do you think there's an investment opportunity here? Anybody? What could you do? I mean, clearly the market is misestimating the risk in Embraer, right? So what if I bought stocks, emerging market stocks like Embraer? I went around the world and I could probably find two or three companies like Embraer in every emerging market, which are being underpriced and undervalued because people are misunderstanding risk. There's a catch though, right? I buy all these companies and what do I hope for? Revelation. Right? You need to wake up to the fact that you've been screwing up. It's actually been one of my most successful strategies. And here's what I do. I wait for a crisis in an emerging market. And there's always one. It's not a question of whether. It's a question of how, you know. You wait for a crisis. You have this. So you have this list ready before the crisis. So crisis happens. You know what happens in crisis, right? Foreign institutional investors dump everything and they leave. They don't care. Good, bad, Embraer, they don't even know. Just dump all Brazil. Go into another country. I'm following them right as they leave. I'm saying, okay, you're leaving. Can I take what not everything, just that one. They're in such a hurry to leave. They'll sell me whatever I want at whatever price. Okay? And I remember I bought Embraer in 2001 at the height of the Lula fear. This was just before Lula got elected. There was this fear in Brazil that he was going to be the next Fidel Castro. He was going to nationalize everything. Country risk premium in Brazil went to like 14%. Everybody was dumping everything in Brazil and leaving. You got a mini version of that last year, right? So that's when I bought Embraer. And I bought it not because it was, that the cash flows were off in any way, but because I said, if I buy this, even though markets think it's a Brazilian company, the truth will come out. You know how it comes out? Brazil had three bad quarters in a row. And Embraer's earnings came in 7% higher, 8%. Because in a sense, they're selling to a global market. They don't care about exchange rate variation in any. In fact, they're helped by the fact that the real gets weaker. So there's a version of that now playing out in Brazil because this Petrobras fiasco is driving Brazilian stocks down across the board. That's the bad news. The good news is in the process, it's opening up investment opportunities for you to think about when you think about where should I invest. So when you get a chance, go through that country risk section. I don't want to start in the implied equity risk premium, but basically I'll set the table on what we're going to do when we come back Wednesday. That's right, Wednesday. Monday, you have that very important day. I'm sure you have other things. The President's Day. This is the most wasted holiday on the face of the earth. What exactly do you do? Pray to Lincoln? I mean, I'm not sure what you're supposed to do. This is a day for you to go to a sale, I guess, or hang out in a mall. But that's a rant for a different day. But when we start on Wednesday, we're going to start with this notion of implied equity risk premiums and come up with a different way of estimating that base number for the U.S. Okay?
Any one of them.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Hi.
So, risk-free rate
say we have like three approaches, so many products on the test. But it will be clear which one of the approaches.
Tighter spreads, and illiquid would be greater spreads, so there wouldn't be
trading. You don't have trading, there's no deviation. You don't measure variation,
Think
of the spreads going towards infinity, nobody would trade.
Looking at a different side,
yeah. So you actually couldn't trade spreads.
Okay.